Good evening. This is the talk on the Vajra Buddha family. And just to take a minute before we begin, to get the idea of, can people see this?
Yeah.
Okay. The idea of the orientation of directions, so that it's a little bit clearer. Because we are taking the Buddha families out of order, and the reason we are taking them out of order is because of our limitations on scheduling everyone who's going to give the presentations. So, to see what the idea of the order is, picture yourself as the Buddha in the center, looking out, straight out. And by convention, the direction in which the Buddha looks out is the east. It's not always the compass direction, east, but it's the east because the east is where the sun rises, and the sun is, we're looking for enlightenment, and the sun is a powerful symbol of enlightenment. So the Buddha, sitting in the center, is looking out to the east. And in the east, by this convention, is the Vajra family, which is colored blue. And then by rotating around, that is, going clockwise, what the Buddha would see or sense on the going right, of course, is the south. And the family there is the Ratna family, with the color yellow, or rich yellow. And the word Ratna means jewel. And then what would actually be behind the Buddha's back would be the west, and that is the Padma family, and the color is red, and the element is fire. And continuing around to the north is the Karma family. The color is green, and the element is the wind. So you had a presentation on this subject a while ago, and I'm not going to go repeating it, but I thought it would be good to have a good demonstration of how the directions actually work. So could someone turn the sheet, please?
You want me to turn it up?
Sure. Just one page. So tonight we're going to talk about the Vajra family, and what you see on the board there is actually the same thing as under the word east on the sheet that you have in your hands. So the family is Vajra, the color is blue, and the element is water, and the defilement or klesha or neurotic aspect of it is anger. So water has many properties, and it also can change in many ways. One of the functions of the primary function of what is the Vajra person doing? The Vajra person is thinking and knowing, and the Vajra person wants to think, wants to know, wants to make sure that nothing has been left out, that there are no surprises going on, and that everything is under control. And when I do this, I find I can get myself pretty uptight, and that gets me into a really frozen state in which it's very hard to get out of, and I get pretty annoyed at myself for that, and I also get annoyed at other people because they don't get it. So the klesha is anger, and sometimes it just feels like a sheet of frozen ice, all white and cold and very upsetting. And sometimes I think that other people are getting upset by it too. I'm not sure that anyone's really listening.
Well, you getting irritated about that?
I don't see what's so funny about that.
We're listening.
But I don't think people are really listening, and it really bothers me. And sometimes my anger feels like it's really cold and frozen like that. And other times it's biting and hot like steam. And steam is a very hot form of anger. People don't get it because they don't know what's coming at them, and you can't really see steam, and it burns kind of deeply. So watch out. And I think people are getting really pretty bored, but I'm just going to go on. Again, it bothers me, and people just laugh at it, and that gets me kind of upset. But no one's really going to tell me what's on their mind. But I think I know. I think you're all going to give me a really bad review when it comes to writing a review of this presentation. And that gets me really upset. So it bothers me. And I could say something about the Vajra maybe, but we'll see what happens. Anyway, this is called a Vajra. And it represents in the center where you see this little round thing, that is the Buddha family. It's the center of it. And there are four prongs going out here, and these prongs are the four elements that we've talked about for the four families. That is the elements of water, earth, fire, and wind. But there's another side to it, which I have to hold up like this. And it really looks the same, but whereas these four elements are feminine in nature, and that doesn't mean that that they have to do only with women. It means it's the feminine wisdom of each of us. And on this side is the same thing, male or male wisdom, which is one of the four Buddhas. And these four Buddhas are actually listed here, and they've got names. And the center one is Vairochana, and the next four, if you read across in the second column, are Akshobhya, Ratnasambhava, Amitabha, and Amoghasiddhi. And for Vajrayana practitioners, they actually have images. They are images like gods. They aren't gods, but they're wisdom Buddhas. And they have consorts, and the consorts are called Mamaki, Dharma Dattvishvari, Mamaki, Lochana, Pandaravasini, and Tara. And they are the consorts, and in Vajrayana Buddhism, the male aspect and the consort are joined in union. So that's that. And again, I know everyone's getting bored and doesn't like my going on and is all set to give me a bad review. So I think I'm just going to quit. quit at this point because it's getting me very upset.
Four stars. Four stars.
Okay. Actually, I love you all, and thank you for not running away. And we can have a discussion any way you like, so if you want to stretch for a minute and get yourself settled and shake out of that, we're all set to have a discussion. We can begin it any way we like.
You would like to look at the body.
Yeah, because I can't, I mean, I couldn't see how the two sides were different.
They are different. They are not different.
But they represent different things. They are actually...
Well, they represent the union.
Right, but different. But how, like, you said this is the male side, this is the female side.
Yeah, but it could be either way. It's just
like you pick it up and say, oh, that's the female side, that's the male side.
Right.
Okay. I kept looking, thinking,
they don't.
He has much better vision than
they don't.
See any difference.
Right, they're not different.
Okay, so why don't you pass that
around? Yeah, you can see it's a lotus, that right there, there's a lotus, there's petals. And this is called makara. It's like a, it's sort of a
I hope you don't make Michael angry.
I know he's going to get angry.
Okay, so while you're doing that, another symbol that's very much used in for the Vajra family is a mirror. Very often it's a round mirror, but any kind of a mirror can do. So the wisdom here is called the.
Mirror.
The mirror-like wisdom. And the mirror-like wisdom is considered to be a pacifying wisdom. So why is something that in its neurotic aspect has to do with anger pacifying? Well, because a mirror, it doesn't have anger that sticks to it. A mirror is completely free of any kind of attachment. If the mirror can reflect a raging fire, it can reflect a horrible battle, it can reflect a love scene, beautiful wine, whatever it's going to reflect, as soon as that image is gone, the mirror holds on to nothing. So the wisdom aspect of the Vajra family is a wisdom that doesn't hold on, doesn't manifest anger, but sees everything very clearly. And if everything is seen very clearly, without anger, without attachment, then that is the way a Buddha sees the world. And it can, the Buddha can help each sentient being in the way that that person needs to be helped. Because the Buddha has seen clearly what's happening with that person.
Michael, would you mind, just something occurred to me in what you just said, is that, and would you mind elaborating on the fact that although Vajra has mirror-like wisdom, and that it can be of benefit in that it can reflect back to whomever is looking into it what is actually truthfully occurring in that moment. And the neurosis of it is as any ego comes in where the Vajra being or entity believes it's that it exists and that its opinion is the solid. So I wondered if you wouldn't mind elaborating on that a bit.
I think you did pretty well. I don't have a great elaboration. There's something else that occurred to me, and I didn't want to bring it up until after the. Maybe Michael can have something to say. That is, the word family here has been bothering me. And when we use the word as in Buddha family, Vajra family, and so on, we do not mean in a sense that, for instance, a family with members in it is a family, because that's not a family, and that's a different thing. That's a mandala. And if we look at this group here, it is a mandala. So I'm a little perplexed as to how to treat that that word family. I thought of maybe calling it a cluster of tendencies, whether enlightened or neurotic, or something like that. Michael, do you have a thought?
Well, actually, the entire, back to that scheme which you looked at here, is actually a mandala itself. Mm-hmm. You have east looking out, you have south, and you can even think of it in cardinal directions, like looking east wherever you are. South is going to be above. West is going to be in back, and north is going to be below, right? So that's kind of a primordial way. It's a unity.
And they're inseparable, actually.
Yeah, and then there's a center. And so, basically, from that point of view, it's more about just the mandala and the components of that mandala. In this sense, when we talk about Buddha, we're talking about enlightened mandala. Or we can talk about a confused or neurotic mandala, which would be those manifestations of the elements that are out of whack or not really aligned with reality. Because awareness is the fundamental nature we're talking about, and awareness has no bias at all. It's just there. It's hard for us to believe, because we always think, because I'm aware, therefore that means something, and therefore I can have an opinion, and that means I can do this and that. But awareness is really before any of those factors go in. And it's present in all of these things. So it's more like, I think family is just trying to make a convenient term. There is no specific mother, father, or child.
No, but I think there's a relationship. That's how I see it. We're not just talking about the five Buddha people or things totally separate in their little separate world, but there's a relationship, and that, in fact, we could all try to label each other or ourselves, but we all have all of them, and so things are interconnected. I think that's what the word family, my guess is, it would be interesting to know how it is and what word they actually use in Tibetan.
But there are five families, right?
I mean, I'm confused. I can see how the whole thing is a mandala.
Yes, it is.
But because it's plural,
right.
I mean, each one is not a mandala by itself.
That's
it?
Right.
Or each one, like the Vajra and the Ratna, each one is a mandala.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so because it's a mandala, it's a family. So these are components, these are mandalas inside a larger mandala.
Right,
okay. Mm-hmm. So there's another thing that needs to be said, which is that looking at the... Thank you.
okay.
I'd like to hold it.
Command and so you should.
You should.
Hold fourth, please.
Hold fourth.
Okay. So this is the way it's actually held. That looking at the whole point of the presentation of the Buddha families, what we're trying to get at is, how does a Buddha see the world, and how can we see the world in the manner in which the Buddha sees the world, which is to say, seeing it as wisdom rather than confusion, because that we already have that wisdom and we are the Buddha. But we need to use words to explain it, and there's no... The Buddha's view of the world doesn't unfold in five successive steps. It just is. And there's no way to talk about it except to choose a order of discussion and discuss it. But there is some sense to that discussion. There is an orderliness in seeing that first there's the primordial, there is primordial space. Then within that there is tremendous clarity. The primordial space is not dull. It's where all the color and joy and pain and everything going on in the world manifests. And there is then excuse me, a clarity to the whole thing that allows it to be seen so accurately and so precisely. And there is the aspect of what is called equanimity, which is the Buddha isn't picking favorites. The Buddha doesn't say, I'm going to help this guy and not that guy. The Buddha's generosity, free of any pride or holding back, just shines everywhere. And the same is going on with what we call discriminating wisdom. That is, there is no saying, well, these are qualities I like, these are qualities I don't like, this is what I'm going to accept, this is what I'm going to reject, these are the ones I'm going to favor, these are the ones I'm going to rip off and give a sleeping pill to, as we heard last week, and dump. Instead, the discriminating awareness savors all the qualities of the world and appreciates them. And finally, the action is without trying to push a program. Therefore, there's space to allow everything to happen, and within that space, the Buddha gets a lot more done than those of us who are confused by trying to force our activity. But all at once. Thank you for letting me rant a little bit.
We don't have a choice.
That's another Bhagavad Gita thing. It's like laying down the law. So did that make sense here, the notion of what you just expressed in terms of how Buddha might see, feel, discern, and act? We're talking about that as part of just a spontaneous activity that occurs naturally and arises of itself and dissolves itself, frees of itself, liberates of itself. One of the aspects of Buddhahood is liberation, and also in the Buddha realm, everything is fundamentally liberated as it arises, rather than having to get out and do something about it or change it or modify it or edit it. So from that point of view, Buddha felt is really the ultimate reality. And what we want to do as practitioners is learn how we can move toward that and discover it in our own experience and truth for ourselves.
So please say whatever is on your mind.
So chaos has an equal value of weight as basic goodness.
Yeah.
Samsara and Nirvana, they're part of the same.
Inseparable.
Chaos is completely natural. In fact, they actually find that chaos actually has order to itself. It actually follows certain kinds of laws in its own way. Chaos theory is helpful to understand.
So it happened, a sense of purpose being contrary to the non-intentionality of primordial activity.
Well, sense of purpose is beyond our conception. And that's the main point to understand here. When we talk about these Buddha dimensions, they are all beyond the reach of conceptual mind. So even though our mind is using concepts to try to make sense out of things and put them together so we can sort of try to communicate and engage with others, once we start doing that in reality, from the point of view of Buddha nature, we're just freezing this stuff up and putting it in the deep freeze and killing it and then dishing it out, as it were. So we're dealing with dead items rather than living items, which is not to be captured by any means of words or trapped. So that's why when we practice meditation, we're learning about this openness, this space, and this clarity, which actually is already there for us to discover and experience.
So how do we intuitively, self-evidently, with a mirror model paradigm,
That's great.
See it. In, how do we see wisdom in primordial?
You need the mirror.
Yeah,
you are the mirror, not the reflections in the mirror.
There's the myth of the enlightenment of the Buddha, which can serve as a very interesting model of this, because it was said that the Buddha had a tremendous realization of enlightenment at dawn, after being awake and meditating all night and getting clearer and clearer and defeating all kinds of attacking forces and seducing forces, which are sometimes called Maras and daughters of Maras. And they could no longer attack them. At dawn, the sun rose, and he attained complete liberation, and he was completely at peace. And he said, "But I can't tell this to anyone because I have no way to express it. How am I going to communicate with these people?" And he just sat there, and then some gods came, first of all, and it was by tradition, it was some of the Hindu gods like Brahma, who said, "You can communicate it, and you need to do so." And so gradually the means to communicate and to talk to anyone according to that person's level of understanding arose.
I think the story was that he was sitting there, and that happened, that he was sort of informed by these higher dimensions of that he did need to be able to express this and share this. And then these people showed up, who his former friends or associates who were yogis with him, and they showed up and said, "What are you doing?" And they started asking him questions. So they kind of pulled it out of him, and he just spontaneously responded to their questions and was able to address their own specific individual concerns just naturally without any kind of effort. Back to this mirror. I mean, this is really, there's a wonderful teaching on YouTube by this guy. He's a Tibetan Lama.
Wangyal?
Yeah, Tenzin Wangyal. And he talks about trying to enter meditation with sensing, just allow your experience to be a mirror. And so you're just present, and be present and be the mirror which can hold any kind of reflection at all. Any kind of image that comes in the mirror doesn't affect the mirror, because it's just basically reflecting it back effortlessly. And there's no attachment to coming or going. And using that as a means to try for, you know, not continuously, but trying it for a few minutes at a time to see if that helps. You enter your state of deeper relaxation and rest and simplicity, so that when these experiences occur in your mind, you're not reacting or getting back and forth or feeling like you need to do or say or anything, alter them in any way. Because they just fundamentally relieve themselves. They're in the process. Does that make sense?
Look at that handsome guy in the mirror.
Yeah.
Look at that silly, arrogant fool.
Are we spelling the name?
Ooh. Look at that pretty girl in the mirror.
What? Oh, yeah.
Where? Who did that attract?
What?
Thank you. Beautiful.
What mirror where?
I don't know.
That's about it.
I'm still dwelling on your question, which has led me to think of something else, which is that, and your what you said, in fact, which is that here's the Buddha who achieved this. He achieved this enlightenment, this awareness, with no language that he was familiar with to use to properly transmit it. And it occurs to me that we still do that. That in fact, none of us can actually totally, utterly capture the pre-thought energy that desperately, that wants to communicate, that eventually plops out of our mouths as a sentence or a question or a description. And that it feels as though we're still doing that in a sense. We can never talk around. We can never specifically say, I am this. Because none of the language is appropriate to describe what this whole thing is.
Would you say that the brain, the mind independent of absent of a self, is the closest
the brain thing to a absent mirror. Of a self.
Yeah. In other words, if we drop the self-image of being a self in you, in meditation, then experience is the closest we can come to a mirror. Because then the senses would not be pigeonholed.
I think it's more simple than that. Mm-hmm. It's not having an agenda or a view or
a purpose.
Purpose is a funny word. But I'm saying, let's just say agenda. We're not having a judgment on a situation. And being there, witnessing and responding without concern about one's own what's invested, what you invest in it.
Yeah.
You want to be right. Without that, that is, I think, the closest thing to it. That mirror, like,
yeah,
Did the world come into existence from a primordial sound?
I'm sorry.
Primordial sound.
You can't hear.
Sound. Do you have a view of that?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Isn't there something about a primordial sound that gave birth to everything?
Mm-hmm. In Hinduism, there certainly is.
I'm not familiar with it at all.
Okay.
Is that the Om sound?
Pretty loud.
Is that by the Om?
I wouldn't
like
know.
Some
that.
Kind of fundamental resonance that sort of hums underneath everything, and that vibratory energy gives rise to various experiences or appearances.
The universe is the world comes into existence as a resonance. That's a
physics, right? I mean, that's string theory, isn't it?
Yeah, physics is saying something like that, but yeah. I think that it's goes way, way back also.
So I wonder if a look at this, the line that says Ganda would be of any help, because that's one thing we haven't really talked much about.
Which one?
It's Ganda.
There you go.
So there is a pattern, usually form, feeling, perception, mm-hmm. karmic formation, and consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So we're working now. Consciousness makes sense. The aspect of thinking and
knowing yeah.
consciousness. So I'm wondering about the first one, form. That's the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
So what arises there as the beginning point? And I think it would just be helpful to look at this because we haven't discussed it yet.
What do we mean by
Rupa? What's form?
What is form?
Yeah, what is that?
In relation,
Rupa.
That word is Rupa,
Rupa
in R-U-P-A.
Yeah, it's a Sanskrit.
It's a Sanskrit
for that. It's that. Usually used in terms of like a little statue of a Buddha.
Well, that's a Rupa, right?
Yeah, that's okay.
That's just an image. Yeah,
an image.
Yeah, it's a Rupa, yeah.
But in this case, it's. I think when we studied the song Skandhas, when we introduced that about two years ago or 3 years ago.
Two years ago in the fall.
And
we brought up the notion that Trungpa Rinpoche is the person who really helped me and others understand what this form realm is when he talked about it as just being something that is continuously appearing and disappearing. It's just all the time. And what happens is that there is this experience of a dance that goes on in our mind, and we begin to spin with this, but the difficulty is that there's a fundamental deep panic that starts to happen when we try to hold on to it or use it as a reference point. So, in other words, just on this primordial ground, which means in the context of 1 second, if you could divide it up into, say, 500 parts, there's this constant flashing and just disappearing, flashing and disappearing, creating and destroying, appearing and dissolving. And the element of mind which would like to have a reference point, which is basically a habit, starts to try to orient itself around that, and it becomes very disturbing because it can't grasp onto these things. And that's creating this basic anxiety. When we talk about suffering in Buddhism, we're not just talking about, oh, woe is me kind of thing, you know, what a terrible life it is. But we're talking about just basically being ill at ease and anxious on some level that's so fundamental that everything else that we do, including all these other manifestations of the various skandhas, are coming from that fundamental point. And so the key is, of course, as we learn how to work with our meditation practices, learning how to rest more deeply so that we don't have to be chasing after those appearances.
But why is it word form? I think of form as, maybe it's a solidification.
Yeah.
So form means
when it solidifies.
That popping up.
So
that we're trying to contain it.
That we're creating the form by solidifying
it. So there's an active quality to it.
Yeah. Yes.
I think there is.
again and again.
Oh, yeah. No, it's very dynamic. Yeah. It's not just sort of some flat, empty vacuum.
Right.
It's just continuously. Just look at ourselves. Look at our experience.
Michael has something.
No, Emily has something. Because when I was preparing this talk, she said, go look at the bottom row, the type of feeling, sorry, the type of suffering, and you then went over the five types of suffering, and maybe that would be a good thing to look at.
Well, we started with freezing, the freezing aspect, because
the first one was
Insentient, no feeling.
That's more about dullness.
Dullness
is more appropriate, I think. Because the Buddha kind of quality, when Buddha is manifesting badly or out of whack, then it's just insensitive. It's just basically it will not register what's going on, and because it's just basically too spaced out, which is the easiest way to put that. But it's spaced out to the degree which it can't even acknowledge what's coming at it in front of itself.
So Vajra, the Vajra energy is freezing.
Yeah.
Freezes the space.
Freezing meaning solidifying and being stuck in the solidification, your own solidification.
I see that.
It's worth going across the road.
Yeah, that feels,
So there you are with form.
There you are. You're stuck. And that's why there's sort of a quality of ice and the sharpness.
Right.
And you can see the anger would arise from that because there's no communication, right? Mm-hmm. You're solidifying
fear
your thing. Fear.
Fear would
arise. And you're solidifying your ego.
Right.
Because...
Well, the whole thing about consciousness, though, with Vajra and freezing is that it's like it's the tip of something pointy.
Yeah.
Tip of the iceberg.
Like, it is.
Yeah.
You know, that because it's so...
Right.
It's about the thought. It's so
pointy.
Great. Compacted, almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So what happens when we freeze up? We basically back off. We isolate ourselves from each other. And the same thing happens in our mind. We solidify And the more we intensify and believe we're absolutely right, the more we cut ourselves off from communication and ability to interact genuinely.
And I'd like to point out the opposites. So we have in the East Vajra, in the West Padma. So Padma, you saw, was all about communication, you know, going out, dragging in, you know, magnetizing, a lot about talking and flowing. And you can see Vajra could be frozen and as you said, you know, cut off and not able to engage. So I think it's interesting to see it as a mandala and the pairs and how they work together even color-wise. Mm-hmm. Here's red and here they are together. It's odd, you know, sometimes.
Even there's the fringe.
The fringe. She's not getting very close.
So look at the next one.
Yeah. Suffocating. That.
I don't want you to get too much into this.
Yeah, because she's going to
show us.
Stepping on your toes.
She's going to show So just to tell you, I mean, Erica's going to act out the Raja family.
Oh, okay.
The
Raja. I know you're talking.
Yeah,
and Emily did the podcast.
I did podcast, so you missed that. And then, and Joseph Crane's going to do the Karma family. So the suffocating is we're not allowed to talk about that because Erica's going to do it. Do you want to say anything, Erica, just as a warm up?
She can't get there.
No, I don't have anything to say about that.
All right, well, we're going to experience.
Does it pair with karma, with struggling and suffering?
Well, that's a good question.
Struggling karma.
I'd like to.
Yeah, karma is very, you know, is also, I think, is totally unsuffocating because they're moving so fast. Nothing sticks to them at all. They're very,
there's fear versus generosity. Or fearlessness, right? Mm. But I think of fear.
I have to think
there
about
is more fear, because you're looking at paranoia, and the issue of being on top to overcome I should let Joseph talk, but he will do
between opening and closing.
And that could also describe what's going on here in each case, that in the type of suffering describes the kind of closing off in each of these temperaments.
Right.
And the beauty is that these are the extremes.
Right.
All of these families... there's an erotic aspect and a sort of an enlightened aspect.
Right.
So it's dangerous to think that, all Padmas are like this, or Padma is only like this, because it isn't. It has many different qualities.
Right.
And I think Rinpoche used to play the qualities game.
The qualities game,
qualities game.
Yeah, but that was much more complex than this. Actually, everybody has all these elements in them, and that's the important thing. It's not just pigeonholing one person and dismissing them because they're supposedly something. We partake of all of those things. We may have more emphasized aspects than others, but they're all present.
Yeah.
Looking at the realms here, the Buddha is both the god and the animal realm. I guess if you're the neurotic part of it is the ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
That's the animal.
And they're both animals and gods are in the six realms are basically fundamentally suffering. They're ignorance. That's the basic problem.
That was good to point out what you just did because there are six realms to be fitted to the five families, and both the animal realm and the gods are in opposite ways ignorant.
So the god is high, but it then is kind of cut off from the sense of, is trying to sort of be just totally in this realm of pleasure and ignoring pain and whatever, and the animal's got his head to the ground, so there's sort of sense of fear of always, being eaten or getting something to eat. So you're always looking down.
That's and just staying with this self-focus. In both cases, it's high self-focus.
Yes.
So a being in the God realm is totally absorbed in their higher meditation, that they want to stay there. They are training themselves to not move from that space.
They fall, right?
Basically. Eventually.
Eventually, they will fall. It's going to wear out. But while they're... And of course, there is high bliss. That's the other thing, because it's all about high, super high, very subtle pleasure. It's not gross pleasure. It's really much more kind of like hanging out in a very ethereal kind of dimension.
It's more the high meditation.
And the animal is so taken up with just the struggle to survive that it has no energy to... left over for any sort of awareness beyond pure survival.
This was the most depressing part of the book we read. It was about the realms.
Tell us about hell.
Yeah, let's hear about hell.
Ah, yes. That's your favorite realm for larger people.
Yeah, what do you think, Mike?
Well, it's said to be hot hells and cold hells. A hot hell is the experience of being so consumed with hot anger that one is being burned and burned and burned, but it's not like you get burned up and die. You're still there to be burned. It's beyond any body burn. The burning is still there. And the opposite one is cold hell, of being continuously frozen, and still you're frozen, and the freezing seems to endure forever and ever and ever, always being frozen.
So is it, with regards to hell, is it, and how it relates to Vajra, is it the fact that it is kind of like... Sartre's no exit, that it is that it does not stop.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Yeah, Sartre's good that so he's got contradictions. You read Sartre, then you read Camus, who contradicts that.
Yeah.
And they're both worth reading and understanding.
Sartre said hell is other people.
Yeah.
But actually, it's the withdrawal from any kind of genuine communication. You're so locked in, you're not having a great time in hell and hanging out with your friends, because everybody is just totally into their own suffering and their own pain, and that's all they can see, and they're really angry and resentful about this. And so that connects very much with anger, the anger factor.
Robert Frost has a poem, Fire and Ice.
Yes.
Oh,
yep.
I was thinking of that.
Yes.
Yeah, it exactly says the same thing.
Mm.
Yep.
Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I know of desire, I hold with those who favor fire, but I think I know enough of hate to say that ice is also great.
Robert Frost is a marvelous poet of terror, by the way. There's nothing cute about him, which some people think there is. It's very profound.
Thank you
for bringing that up.
I'd like to ask, how did this chart get constructed? Did it evolve from like the three circles? Or?
It got photocopied.
That's a Vajra answer, right?
That's the ultimate mirror is, right, in the photocopy.
Right. I had a question about the mirror. So is that like, if you were like a mirror, then that would be the antidote to anger? Like,
yeah, because you're not, there's no opinion about a mirror, and you're not reacting.
Right.
You're simply reflecting.
Right.
Can you be the mirror?
So what I was thinking is it's probably the antidote to a lot of other things too, like pride and attachment, no? Is it only for anger? You know what I'm saying? Is it specifically?
Well, all the that quality of mirror-like wisdom, it brings peace, and so it would dispel all of the neurosis of all these other. That's why it's considered, Vajra is considered so important, because it can pacify. Pacifying is one of its actual qualities. So they have four. We have four what we call karmas of the Buddha families: pacifying, enriching, magnetizing, and destroying. And so pacifying is the karma of the Vajra family.
Thank you.
They are intertwined. You can't really separate them. Yeah.
But it's interesting, they aren't on this chart, because they're not, I mean, they're not always considered part of the Buddha families, that those four karmic energies.
They're considered part of the karma family.
Right.
They're discussed under the karma family.
Right. So that's why they don't fall under the chart, I think, the five families.
That is the activity of the karma family.
Right.
As enlightenment, the Buddha's karma activity is, the Buddha can pacify, and if that's not good enough, the Buddha can enrich the situation. The Buddha can seduce and welcome the situation, and if none of those are good enough, destroy the situation, which is the fourth karma.
It could subjugate. That's another term for karma.
Subjugate.
Cutting through.
Yeah, but the reason why they didn't put this on here, because there is no karma for Buddha family. It doesn't have a corresponding activity or power in that context.
So for the people that may have joined us later with this material, we started several weeks ago, and those talks are online. The first couple talks are online, and one's on the mandala principle itself. And I kind of lost track of what we were doing.
But for a couple of people, who wasn't here last week?
So, yeah. And John was here, but that was
here,
your first class.
The
ones before.
So
the ones before that. We started in March.
I was just going to say, you missed an incredible performance of Emily coming dancing in with a very seductive melody called
La Vida Loca.
Crazy Life.
And seductress coming in, dancing around seductively, and taking her seat, and coming forth about seducing the. It was all about me.
Hollywood actress. The Hollywood actress
being all about me.
All about me.
It was a really wonderful performance.
Yes. It was fun, and I had trouble getting out of it. I was for the next 3 days, I was into this whole thing.
You are pretty cute.
It was fun. It's fun.
Is there, and again, this may be like so broad a generalization, but do you find, of course, we all have all of these families within us, and there are some things are reign more strongly in individuals. And with Vajra, I thought distinctly about my experience last year in a Buddha meditation. Do you find that you will see Vajra like people in certain professions more so than others?
Yes.
For instance,
yes.
Such as?
Well, just look at this example. How often do you sit in a classroom and hear someone lecture? I mean, the whole educational system is designed by Vajras, for Vajras. And those of us, yes, it is. Because if you're like me, there are all the things I wanted to learn that nobody ever taught. Nature, birds, I mean, things that were feeling and, you know, more experiential learning. It's not about that. Schools are designed for Vajra. So,
except for Waldorf schools.
Except for Waldorf, yeah. Well, that was a big exception.
And Vajra, because Vajra can be so dominant in those environments,
yes,
they tend to freeze the situation.
Exactly.
So that somebody,
yes,
who comes at it from a different perspective,
right,
gets frozen out.
That's right.
And they're not acknowledged.
Right, right, they're right.
No.
Yeah.
And that's
right.
Fair.
And their way of learning isn't respected or appreciated.
Sure,
yeah. If people come more from intuition, you know, that's really shut down in this culture.
But in this culture, it's all about
intellect.
Well, last week, Emily told about how her job as an HR person was perfect for Padma. So that's another way,
right,
you can look at, you know.
I mean,
Emily is not a Padma person.
Yeah.
You
can be Padma if you want to be.
I can be, yeah.
But I want to take something,
okay,
I want to re-examine something you just went by.
Okay.
I don't think that in this country intellect is viewed as the highest possibility.
Certainly not.
What people in this country view the most is money. There's a famous old saying, if you're so damn smart, why ain't you rich?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and this is basically how people view their intellectual. They don't trust because they're intimidated by it. A lot of people are. And there's a high distrust. I mean, I have to tell you, even though but I think the key point that you're bringing up, and this is where we can understand how Vajra works in us, is where we conceptualize. Conceptualization is freezing up and putting things away and
mm-hmm,
putting them in the deep freeze and take,
mm-hmm,
you know, that's what we're going to keep for a little baggage. But our mind that does that is part of our Vajra nature, that aspect of ourselves. So if we can learn how that works and begin to realize how we are captives of that process, we can also undo it. It's just like when you go to school, you learn a lot of things, and then you realize later you have to unlearn a lot of those things that were spoon-fed you because you've got to have your own experiences teaching you other ways of understanding. And likewise, we are these programs that we carry around in ourselves that are conceptual. And so our Vajra part is to learn how to dismantle that on some level, which we do through... It's not like, you know, some kind of intellectual effort. We're talking about just being present in meditation and using our meditation as a means to actually realize that this is just a series of assumptions we carry around in ourselves. And we can just relax instead of feeling like we either have to defend them or get rid of them.
You pointed out something very important that we live in an environment in which both intellect and culture are devalued.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Roberta?
Well, so we talk about the obsession with money and everything, you know, that this culture has. Would this be more in the karma family of jealousy?
Oh, that's part of the competitiveness
that
puts everybody in this rat race.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah, what do you do? What do you do for work? You know,
you define yourself
party.
Efficiency without ambition, not necessarily for
karmic formation.
I think it's
done. Are we ready?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, everyone.